Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, May 12th, welcome, 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 friends, on into the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
So today's political headlines feel less about politics and more like pressure points. For example, Iran war surges inflation as Trump's approval rating hits low record. A fragile ceasefire in the Middle East and how the Supreme Court gutted black voting power. Ouch, right? And those are just the national headlines. Here at home, Philly's ice out legislation is now law. There's congressional races. There's a lot going on. So today we're going to do a national and regional roundtable with two pundits that we've had on the show before. We've got Solomon Jones from WURD, and we got Terry Tracy, founder of Broad and Liberty here. And of course, we want to hear from you. What are the big stories that you, friends, are following most closely? And give us the reason why. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And we tend to do this when the stories kind of pile up, which is a lot lately.
Traffic jam of stories.
Which is a lot lately. Uh-huh. And those inflation numbers came out today, and we were like, oh, well, we got two smart people. We're going to parse through. They have differing points of view, so perfect time to do a roundup.
Do a roundup at the round table. That's not actually a round table. I love it.
Yeah.
What story are you following most closely and why? The number again is 888-477-9499. Call us. Join the show.
Yeah, we want to hear from you.
And our email is studio2@whyy.org. We're your friends. And you know what friends also do? They do a trio of local news stories.
Yes, friends, start, Avi.
To start the show. Story number one here. Pennsylvania Supreme Court Justice David Wecht announced yesterday he is formally leaving the Democratic Party over what he called, quote, acquiescence to Jew hatred. Mm. In a statement, Wecht, who is Jewish, said, quote, Nazi tattoos, jihadist chants, intimidation, and attacks at synagogues and other hateful anti-Jewish invective and actions are minimized, ignored, and even coddled. So he is now becoming officially an independent. Mm-hmm. Wecht is a longtime member of the Democratic Party. He was even the state party's vice chair before becoming an elected judge. He was a member of the Democratic Party last fall when voters elected to retain him and two other Democrats for another 10-year term on the state Supreme Court. In the statement announcing his decision, Wecht did not point to any specific examples of Democrats promoting or acquiescing to anti-Semitism. So there are some gaps that I guess the public has to fill in here. But either way, it's a big announcement in the world of Pennsylvania government.
No, it's a big deal. And it's not lost on me. Like you said, he waited until he was reelected for a 10-year term to make this announcement. Because in a lot of ways, it would have been political suicide to do it before the retention race, because it was a very contentious race, and you need party support for the ads, ward leaders, etc. But in a lot of ways, Wecht is not alone, though. I mean, now that he's elected and he knows that he's going to be situated for 10 years, a lot of folks have been shifting out of the Democratic Party, actually both parties, for a while. It's been a trend here in Pennsylvania, but more so from the Democratic Party for folks to become independents or unaffiliated. And it's gotten worse between 2024 and 2025.
Yeah.
So,
and the timing, obviously, you could say it's a little suspect. We don't know. Maybe something changed between in his conscience between November and now, or there was something that happened because his statement doesn't gesture to any one act or person. It's a little tough to say. But you know, we've seen people who've like broken with Trump and done it sort of after there would be consequences, you know, after they announced that they're retiring or something like that. So it's not totally like
unusual. But I mean, and it's in a way it would be politically savvy to wait because, I mean, it was a contentious race, but to also make this statement now. And a lot of other people feel the same way.
Absolutely. And it made national headlines.
This was picked up.
I think CNN picked it up. It ended up being a big deal. And he's been a major player in the state Democratic Party for a long, long time.
Yep.
Let's move now to story number two, Cherry.
Yes. An undocumented Reading resident is in a detention center facing deportation to Mexico after helping police investigate the murder of his daughter. Last year, Erasmo Zavala Almanza's 20-year-old daughter and her 2-month-old baby were shot by the father of the newborn, who then took his own life. The daughter, whose name is Selena, she also died, and the baby girl barely survived. Zavala Almanza helped police in the homicide investigation, which qualified him for what is called a U visa. And a U visa typically shields victims and witnesses who help law enforcement in investigations of serious crimes from deportation. The policy goal is public safety. The government wants to encourage undocumented people to come forward and to help law enforcement. And so, you know, Zavala Almanza applied for the U visa. He disclosed his undocumented status, but U visa protection policies have shifted under the Trump administration. And so last month, ICE agents came to his home, arrested him, put him in detention, and now he faces imminent deportation back to Mexico.
Right. And he's arguing that, you know, he needs to stay in the country to help care for his granddaughter, who is trying to
recover
from this horrible tragedy. And, you know, obviously her mom's not here to help with that. I will credit, by the way, the Inquirer and Jeff Gamage for bringing this story to our attention. It's worth your time. You should read the whole thing. It's an illustration of how immigration priorities and enforcement have changed. A stark illustration of that.
Yeah.
It's a very tough story to read. But I do think, you know, if you're able to take some time with it, it's worth reading.
And I just want to point out before we move on that, you know, I covered immigration as a reporter and some of the U visa cases. And there was a big concern that, you know, you push undocumented people underground because you won't help police. You'll hide from police. You won't, you know, call 911 and, you know, report crimes because you don't want to get deported. And so when you hear this story, it raises public safety concerns.
Yeah. Moving finally now to story number three, the end of this segment. if you want to celebrate America's 250th birthday by getting a little bit sloshed, I've got good news for you. 31 hotel bars across Philadelphia have banded together to create the Cocktail Trail for the semi-quincentennial this summer.
That rhymes.
It does. It does. Credit to Philly Voice for writing this up. Each of these bars has a special cocktail or mocktail, maybe both, inspired by the nation's founding, some based on old recipes, some that are just colored red, white, and blue.
Okay.
Visit Philadelphia has a map where you can find the whole cocktail trail. Yes, it rhymes.
Mm-hmm.
And you can keep track even of which ones you've tried. The cocktails are available through September 30th if you want to walk, and please walk, the cocktail trail this summer.
And I want to underscore that there are some mocktails as well. I love some of the names. They have the Schuylkill Punch at the First Daughter Oyster Company. That's their house rum punch. And then they have the Cosno mocktail.
Cosno?
Cosno.
Oh, because it's non-alcoholic.
Play on words. Yeah. Non-alcoholic. Yeah. And then the Red Owl Tavern has the Walnut Street, which is souped up old fashioned. And then they have the, and then they have the Garden Smash, which is like a strawberries and basil mocktail. So
you've looked deeply into
this list. Yeah, I think I'm going to do
it. Sounds like you're about to walk the cocktail trail.
I think I'm going to walk the cocktail trail.
All 31?
I don't know. I have to break that up week by week. I don't think I have it in me.
I couldn't get through it once. I would need multiple summers. I need another 250 years before I can get through all 31.
I can see myself, you know, picking one spot on a weekend or something like that.
This all feels tailor-made for a local content creator to, like, do the whole cocktail trail in one go and get progressively more buzzed and maybe, like, wear, like, a tri-corner hat while they do it.
Yeah. So dress up. Dress up, please. Do your best 250th anniversary gear.
So if you're going to do that, all we ask is that you credit us for the idea. So
tag us, please.
Please
I
tag
will share.
Us, collab. We love to, but we don't encourage anyone, to be clear, to drink to excess.
No, mocktails.
You can do the mocktail trail.
You can
trail.
Do the mocktails.
Yeah,
totally.
So anyways, if you want to hit the cocktail trail, it's available this summer. And I have to say, it is actually a good tribute to the founding fathers, who we've learned through our research over the last year were basically buzzed all the time.
Yeah, they drank beer because it was cleaner than the water.
Yeah, so
and the babies, not the babies, but the kids drank it too.
The babies were drinking beer.
But the kids drank beer too.
But it was less alcoholic.
Yes.
I do think these cocktails would have knocked over the founding fathers. However, it's not it's not unpatriotic.
No.
To be a little drunk.
Absolutely not. Especially if you're wearing your outfit.
Especially if you're wearing your outfit.
Yeah, put some capris
on. This segment is starting to sound a little bit drunk, so let's transition to our roundtable, which
Absolutely.
Is coming up on the other side of this break. You're listening to Studio 2.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. New inflation numbers out this morning. The prognosis is not great. Prices are at a three-year high and wages are not keeping up, even though the most recent jobs report was stronger than expected.
Yeah, and states are also duking it out in a redistricting war over congressional maps ahead of the midterms this year. And this comes on the heels of a Supreme Court decision that weakened the Voting Rights Act's protections for minority voters.
Amid those fights, Pennsylvania has become even more crucial for Democrats in their push to retake control of the U.S. House, with four seats expected to be very competitive. All that, plus the growing national tension on the 3rd District primary race between Dr. Ayla Stanford, Representative Chris Rabb, and Senator Sharif Street.
Almost too much to talk about, but we're going to try today.
Almost.
We're going to try, okay? And we have two guests in our studio right now. We have Solomon Jones, a host at WURD and columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Solomon, so great to have you back on the show.
Great to be here.
We also have Terry Tracy, founder of Broad and Liberty and CEO of Fideri News Network. Terry, great to have you back as well.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure as always.
And we'd love for you to chime in, as some of you already are. What story are you following most closely and why? Or maybe just give us your thoughts on a story that really matters a lot to you. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the live chat.
Yeah, Lobster on YouTube says, still keeping up with the failing economy. And so that's where we're going to start. I'm not going to characterize it as failing, but those numbers came out today. Inflation numbers, 3.8%. For the first time in 3 years, inflation is higher than wage growth. You know, and Americans are big mad. Terry, I'm going to start with you. Your thoughts, how are Republicans going to message around this? You know, I mean, this is hard.
Yeah, I don't think you message around it. I don't think getting around it is the goal. I think you have to take it on head on. I don't think, while there are definitely some green shoots in the economic numbers. And when we were last together, I think it was the Q1 numbers came out and they were surprisingly good. Mm-hmm. You know, the jobs report was significantly better than expected. And it looks like as long as the government and people are willing to keep spending money they don't have, you know, things will kind of stay on track.
Yeah.
But the fundamentals of the economy are going to continue to be at minimum in question until there is more clarity around what happens with the conflict in Iran and in the Middle East. The reality is, gasoline is a global market, and as long as the global markets are disrupted, it's going to create a lot of pressure on the economy. And, you know, this was a choice that the administration made, knowing that this could very well be an outcome. And I think it comes down to the merits of whether that choice was the right thing to do for the country. And that's what Republicans have to focus on, is not messaging around the economy, but taking the numbers head on and explaining why they're headed in the right direction and the right choices have been made.
What's the counter message, Solomon Jones?
The counter message is that the wrong choice was made, that there was no need to go into this war, that the president tore up an agreement that he's now trying to renegotiate back to the original agreement that he tore up, and that it's literally because of those choices that we're in this position.
Yeah.
We're in a position where you have that 3.8% inflation. I don't think you can talk your way around that. Unfortunately, the president can't stay on message. It would be great if he would for the Republicans, but he won't.
Where's the message drift, as you say?
He should be talking about making things affordable for Americans. Instead, he's saying affordability is a hoax. When during his campaign, he talked about bringing prices down because people were unhappy with inflation when Biden was in. So this is not a Republican or Democratic problem. This is an economic problem. and one that I think the administration has to be honest about. Unfortunately, their lead messenger is telling us that it's everybody but him.
And so, Terry, then what's the counter to that? Like, how do you sort of talk to voters when affordability was the reason why you were elected, why your party was chosen, and yet it seems like other things took priority, like the war in Iran?
Well, one thing that we can say is categorically true is none of the four people around this table saw the intelligence that led up to the decision to attack Iran. And I think that what we've seen during the conflict is that the regime in Iran has been profoundly dishonest about its capacity and what its armaments look like. I mean, the intercontinental ballistic missiles that were launched, right, that into the Indian Ocean could have very well reached any of the major capitals in Europe. And that was contrary to what the regime had indicated they had the capacity to do before. So given the president's history on this issue, I mean, anti the Iraq war back in the early aughts, right? He has been anti-interventionist by and large, and relative to any president in modern history from both parties, he's been hesitant to do these kinds of things. Mm. So the fact that he did this tells me that he believed that the mullahs were much closer to a nuclear weapon or something else that presented a legitimate national security threat to the country. Because here's a man that was willing to do anything to get gasoline prices under $2 again, just like he did in his first term. He didn't wake up one morning and say, you know what, I really like to screw the American people and have gas be $5 a gallon. Mm-hmm. Something transpired that made a man change his mind and believe that this was the right thing to do.
But why do you think that hasn't been communicated?
Because that was my point to your first question.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, to Solomon's point, he said, your lead messenger all over the place. Like, welcome to the last 10 years. The guy can't stay on message. He changed. Yeah. It's the and you know, for someone like me, I sort of follow the bouncing ball and I find it informative and entertaining. But I get if, you know, you're not that ideological, you're not that political, you're listening to the way he's speaking about these issues, it's very hard to sort of understand the rationale. And I do think the Secretary of State has been a much better messenger on this issue, but the messaging has been relegated to sort of foreign policy considerations. That case needs to be broadened. And I think if you do that, you know, it starts to mitigate some of the political concerns.
Let me read a couple comments in. And by the way, we'd love to hear from you. If you're on Facebook or YouTube, drop a comment in the chat. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. We're covering it at all this hour on Studio 2. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. Yelena on YouTube says, this administration just went ahead and started bombing without any kind of analysis. That's the way Yelena sees it. I like this comment from Mark in Green Lane, Pennsylvania. I had a discussion with a right-leaning neighbor. And his answer to everything, the administration's ongoing wars, corruptions, meanness, mendacity, was this. Quote, they all do that. Everything is now costing Americans more, especially our cynicism and apathy. And this is the question that leads me to Solomon Jones. Why would a voter like that, who just feels so alienated, trust the Democrats to fix any of this when inflation was really bad under a Democratic administration not so long ago? Like, what is the actual positive message from the left to say, yes, you want us to be helping to deal with this problem?
Well, I think that you have to talk about majorities and you have to explain to people how government works, that the reason that you have Republicans fighting so hard to cheat their way, quite frankly, into getting a majority in the House is that with a majority, you can get things done. With a majority, you can push things through. I think that Democrats have to talk about a national message, a message that is about making things better economically for Americans all across the board, whether you're a liberal or a conservative or a moderate or a progressive, that at the end of the day, we all have wallets and our wallets are a little bit lighter under Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And so that has to be the message.
Yeah. And, you know, and we think about gas prices and all the things. Do you think Democrats are using every opportunity available to them to really, you know, hammer the Trump administration, hammer Republicans when we're talking about the economy, when we're talking about this war in Iran, as we are going through these primaries every single week over the past few months?
I think one of the things, and I'm going to give Donald Trump some credit here, one of the things that he did that was brilliant was to buy his own social media platform. Because he has that, he drives the news cycle. He writes something crazy 3 o'clock in the morning, and we report on it seriously, as if this is a serious thing. And so he sucks all the air out of the room. I think that Democrats have to stick to the economy. They have to stick to people's pocketbooks. You know, it's not ideological for everybody, But again, the one thing that we can agree on is that gas is $4.50.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But let me as, before we shift off of the economy, you did mention the green shoots, Terry Tracy, and we did hear a lot of doomsday messaging when Trump instituted the tariffs, made some other pretty, let's say, bold moves with his economic agenda early, and stock market still good, jobs numbers still good, labor market still strong. Like, if the president can message those things, is there a message that you can massage there that helps Republicans, you know, in the midterms?
Sure, and you know exactly why inflation is being driven.
Sure, it's a cause and effect.
It's a cause, right? So you have to make the case that this pain is worth it in the long run for whatever reason. That is what the administration has to do. Then, of course, explain the fact. As I said to you guys a couple of months ago when we had the debate over the tariffs, I said, it's just too soon to say. Mm-hmm. And you have to give these things and the global markets some time to sort this out before you just say, look at these, you know, this is what's going to happen. And the reality is the Democrats, I mean, in the place, Solomon, where they have the largest majority, California, they're giving out diapers and calling that affordable when gas is $8 a gallon. So when you look at Democratic policies, where Democratic governors have – so we're not just going back to Biden and blaming Biden, because that whataboutism that the one I think is bad, right? But you can point to a leading presidential candidate running the largest economy in the country.
You're talking about, right? Newsom.
Newsom, yes, who has implemented every progressive fantasy piece of legislation on the economy you could imagine, and people are fleeing the state because you can't afford to live there. And when you can't buy a home and you can't pay for gas and you can't find a job that allows you to have quality of life, and the governor stands up and says, here's 40 free diapers, that's not a winning message that Democrats have. Yeah. And the administration can point directly to Democratic governance and saying, while this may be challenging, when you put their policies compound the problem.
Yeah.
But how do you explain that things were more expensive in California when Schwarzenegger was the Republican governor? California's always been more expensive than every place else, except maybe Hawaii. And so you can't point to the governor and say he's the reason that gas prices are where they are. Gas prices are always more expensive in California, and they're more expensive now because of the war started by the
Democrats.
And by the way, we're going to move on. By the way, listeners, what story are you following most closely and why? The phone number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. NYC215 says, saving the Voting Rights Act is my number one priority as a citizen. Also, right now, big money in politics is a very big issue. And so I want to talk about voting rights. There are battles over redistricting maps all across the country. We don't have that issue here right now in Pennsylvania, but I mean, I want to get your reaction to, number one, that ruling from the Supreme Court, and then just sort of the ripple effect that we're seeing across states, across the country, taking very swift action. When legislators can't get anything done, swift action is happening in states like Tennessee, Louisiana, and others.
Yeah. Well, I think, first of all, you have to call this a racial issue. The reason that the Voting Rights Act was passed is because black people were not being allowed to vote in spite of the 15th Amendment giving us the right to do so. And so when you scuttle the Voting Rights Act, when you start with it in 2013 and states run out and try to change their laws immediately, when you do it again very recently and states run out and try to change their laws immediately, the people that they are targeting are not Democrats. They are black people. They are black people who have been given the opportunity to elect the representative of their choice. They are black people who are easy to identify in terms of where they live because segregation was put in place to put us in certain places. They are black people who do not vote for the party that is driving this change in our laws. And so this is a racial issue that translates to political power for the Republican Party. And I don't know that you can identify it as anything other than that. Given that that is the case, I think that as a country, we have to, I think, target businesses that come out of those particular states. I think we have to do, we have to focus on economics and we have to focus on politics, but we have to come together to do what is right. If you're going to win on ideas, not on a map.
Do you think, Terry, this is going to backfire on Republicans? Because it does look bad in a state like Tennessee when you have one black district in, you know, in one part, and they have one Democratic district, and Republicans immediately try to split it up. How do you think this will backfire on the GOP?
Generally, I think this whole sort of escalating conflict between the two parties across the country over the gerrymandering stuff is bad for the country, and I wish that there was a way to de-escalate it. That's my personal sentiment. But, you know, analyzing the situation, in your initial comments, you said we don't have this problem here. Well, we don't have the problem here right now because Pennsylvania is where
right
it started.
Now. Yeah.
Right? This whole conflict started when the Pennsylvania Supreme Court redrew the lines and did not kick it back to the legislator in 2018. And when you look at what the way that it is an inherently political process that must be done through by virtue of elected officials, the legislator, the General Assembly, the House, the Senate. What happened in Pennsylvania was the justices that had the Democrat justices that had a majority on the court decided to not only say that the lines were unconstitutional, but then redraw the lines themselves and not have the people's elected representatives redraw the lines, which really in many ways established the baseline for the fight that we're having now. And on the racial issue, I agree with Solomon, but to an extent, but I think it cuts both ways. Because what I saw Democrats do was dilute many majority-minority districts in the General Assembly in order to move minority, primarily African-American voters, into Republican kind of swing districts in the suburbs in order to put their thumbs on the scale. Whether you're looking at places like, you know, at the national level, New England, or at the state level, southeastern Pennsylvania, and you look at the number of registered Republicans that live in those areas, and then you look at the number of Republicans that actually hold elected office, what it tells you is these districts have been carved up in order to benefit whoever is in power and whoever is controlling the system.
How do we get off this ride that it seems like none of us want to be on? Mm-hmm. Like, does anyone have any ideas here to how to get all this race to the bottom with gerrymandering? Any ideas?
Yeah, I think that what you have to do is you redistrict every 10 years. And you allow the state legislatures to do it. I agree with that. But I also disagree with trying to say that these judges on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court don't represent the people. They're voted into office. They are representatives of the people, and they are supposed to uphold the law. They did the best they could to do that. And to try to point back to them as if they are the reason that the Supreme Court made this decision and states are now running in the South to change their lines, I think is, you know, a little bit of whataboutism. It's a little bit of that. And it's a little bit of trying to blame people that don't have anything to do with this. This is about a Southern strategy of trying to make sure that Republicans hold the majority in the House.
And Terry, I will challenge that because, you know, this Roberts Court has been going after the Voting Rights Act for decades. And so well before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court got involved. And so this, if you talk about the VRA issue specifically, this was already.
Yeah, I don't want to conflate issues. Yeah. There are a number of, frankly, constitutional considerations, mm-hmm. both at the federal and state level, that play into this. So you can't look at any one decision in terms of, well, the Roberts Court is looking at this and the VRA, or the gerrymandering fight generally and how we got to where we got here.
You're saying
and they're
that
not,
it's two separate
they're
things.
Two sep- Let me ask they are you, separate but related.
On the point of potential solutions, though, what Solomon raises this idea, I think what you're saying, is some sort of federal standard every 10 years,
every 10 years.
Some sort of federal set of laws. Now, Terry, as someone who I think generally would maybe identify as a Federalist who doesn't want necessarily those types of top-down prescriptions, in this case, could you see that being a palatable solution? Because when this is left up to the states, as you mentioned, there is this just like insatiable appetite for power.
Yeah, I mean, this is my answer is going to be sort of academic because it's going to be divorced from the reality of the politics of the moment. But if I could wave a magic wand and get something done to address it, it would be through a constitutional amendment.
Yeah.
Because that would address the federalism concerns because you'd have to have 2/3 of the states on board.
Right.
Right. So it would compel a compromise.
In your perfect world,
that's the way
to
do it.
So there would be a federal standard, but you would get there through the path of
amendment. Right. Because in the moment that we're in, a federal solution is going to result only in a majority with the slimmest of majorities, one side or the other,
and then it gets
ramming
reversed.
Something through, and then we get into executive order. Because then what happens is future administrations will interpret that to say the president has the power to impose X, Y, and Z. And once you have these issues being handled by any, you know, one administration or executive, you've got a real problem.
I think I just got to just reiterate and underline the point that this is about race. I have to say it. Because in order for Republicans to try to gain this majority in these southern states, they are literally going to black districts where black people live and splitting them up. We have to talk about it.
Yeah.
I'm happy to have that conversation. I just don't know if you have the time for it. But I think Solomon's right. I just think that that particular issue cuts both ways. And I think conservatives have a credible argument that packing black folks in a certain district also dilutes their power. Because you have one seat in a state with nine seats, what exactly is the utility out of that? So, and a lot of these seats, quite frankly, are gerrymandered. Like Clyburn's district in South Carolina looks a lot like the Pat Meehan district in 2016 that was the impetus for the change in Pennsylvania. So he is right, but it is not as clear-cut one side or the other.
Why do black people all live in the same place? Why is that the case? Why is it so easy to identify where black people live?
Yeah.
Well, segregation. It's racism. That's what it is.
And I wonder, and this is why it goes back to my question, I wonder if this will backfire on Republicans. Because, and I don't know what you think about this, because a lot of folks, when you start taking away rights.
Because the opposition will message around it and say this is racist.
Whenever you take away some rights or people feel rights are threatened,
sure,
it rallies the base. And I think there's probably, like you, Terry, a lot of Republicans who feel uncomfortable with some of the moves that some of these states are making.
Well, yes? I think, there's lessons to be derived from Virginia, right? I mean, they did it the wrong way. They did two entirely partisan. Yes, the referendum passed, but the court said you can't do it this way. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you're right. I think process does matter. I don't think all black people necessarily live in the same area. You're seeing massive changes in the suburbs in a lot of areas. So I don't think that some of the assumptions from the mid 20th century that are right, and that is the genesis to how we got here, mm-hmm, are necessarily germane to the policy decisions that are being made and the political implications today.
But we have to move on to our next topic. Yeah. I do want to read in some comments, though, because we have several of them. And, you know, we don't want to neglect the good folks listening to the show.
Yeah.
Frank says, in the recent election in Hungary, about 80% of voters came out to oust an authoritarian leader. In 2025, 34% of registered Philadelphians voted, highest number in a decade. There's a very important midterm primary happening next week. Who is trying to stoke turnout? That's something Frank is thinking about. Mm-hmm. Tom from Hunterdon County, New Jersey, says this war in Iran is all about distraction to the Epstein files. Look, a bear on YouTube says, I want to be an independent, but I also want to vote in primaries. I thought that was an interesting comment. We want to move now to the folks that are already in Congress, not the folks who maybe are trying to get into Congress. And let's look at what's happening with our local delegation here. Starting with John Fetterman, who is a Democrat. Who is a Democrat?
Is he?
Who is a Democrat? No. Is a Democrat?
Somebody
said
that.
Pennsylvania. I'm sure you saw this story, the Politico story about Republicans maybe trying to woo him. Do you give this any credence, Terry Tracy? This idea that John Fetterman would really become a Republican?
I mean, sure. Why not? I mean, the same reason like Angus King is an independent or Bernie Sanders. Sure, if you can get one more vote, why not try? I mean, it's if you can pat it in some way, shape, or form. But I actually wrote my column this week was on exactly this issue. I read Senator Fetterman's comments in the Washington Post on Friday night, and I was sort of moved to respond because I think that there are a lot of ghosts of Pennsylvania politics past here with Arlen Specter. And the argument that I made in that column was that John Fetterman should remain a Democrat. Like even as a conservative guy who would love to have more of a majority for the conservatives in the Senate, his utility to the American political discussion conversation is within the Democratic Party. The minute he leaves the party, he's just another former Democrat outside the coalition,
right,
levying a partisan attack. The reality is Fetterman votes with Democrats 85-90% of the time, just like Arlen Specter used to vote with the Republicans 85-90% of the time. Mm-hmm. But he was willing to speak out on the Affordable Care Act and the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act in 2009 and say the Republicans have this issue wrong, and they kicked him out of the party. If the Democrats are willing to do that over border security and
Israel
and Israel, then they're making a mistake.
And your thoughts?
I've interviewed John Fetterman several times, and that's why my disappointment with him is so great. Because he sat and looked me in the face and basically presented himself as someone who was this liberal Democrat. Quite frankly, they weren't using progressive at that time. But, you know, he's turned out to be someone who votes with Republicans on important issues. You know, if you vote with Democrats 85% to 90% of the time on, you know, stuff that really doesn't matter as much, I don't think it matters as much. And so I'm disappointed with John Fetterman. There were some red flags about him. He had chased down a black man with a shotgun and held him, you know. And so there were some things about John Fetterman.
Those red flags, are those, is that something you're thinking about now as the party considers whether or not to throw its support behind, say, a Graham Plattner? And they're very different people. I get that.
Yeah.
But there were, it was not, to treat the Fetterman thing like a total surprise, I think would be a little disingenuous for Democrats.
I think so too.
Right?
I think so too.
So now, and you have to make this analysis with every candidate who comes in, not just Plattner, right?
Yeah.
I mean, do you think there is a lesson to be learned if indeed, you know, for people who share your opinion on Fetterman's evolution?
I think that we have to hold people accountable.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people are going to change their minds. People are going to vote based on their own ideology. People aren't going to represent those who put them in office. That happens across the board. But they have to be held accountable when they do it.
Sure.
And John Fetterman does, too.
And we're going to go to break in about a minute or so. But I want to ask you specifically about our other senator.
Yeah,
Dave
we never talk about him.
We Dave never
McCormick.
Talk about him. But
and he made some headlines.
He has spent some time in Philadelphia. He was hanging in West Philly. He went on a tour with the mayor. I don't remember the last time we had a Republican senator sort of palling around and hanging out with the mayor of Philadelphia. Terry, do you?
Pat Toomey a little bit, Arlen Specter for sure.
Yeah, right, right. That's like, we're talking back.
Well, that's why, you know, I brought up the Specter comparison because I think it's relevant. But look, Senator McCormick, he is pushing hard for the redevelopment of the Bellwether District. He's working across the lines in order to get that done. He believes that there's massive economic transportation for the good for the city. And he's willing to work with anybody who's willing to work with him to create jobs, opportunity, and prosperity. And Mayor Parker, to her credit, has done that. And I think the fact that he's willing to show up in all 67 counties and hand out sandwiches and shake hands and boots on the ground and hear what people have to say shows he's in touch and he's bringing those sentiments back.
By the way, there was some backlash for Parker appearing with McCormick.
Exactly.
What did you
and
think
McCormick
about?
Got that too.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Oh, of course. But I'm just curious for Solomon's reaction to that backlash. I'm not saying there was a huge backlash or anything.
But
like,
if you look in the comments.
Yeah. What do you think about that? The fact that should she not, you know,
well, unfortunately,
hang out?
She gets backlash on everything.
Sure.
And I think that goes partly to kind of who she is and what she represents as the first black woman to be mayor of the city of Philadelphia. But I think that you have to work across the aisle. You have to be able to work with people regardless of what party they come from in order to get stuff done. That's just the political reality, and that's what she did.
We're coming up on a break now.
Yeah.
We're talking with Solomon Jones. We're talking with Terry Tracy. We're talking kind of just about everything
this
hour. We want to hit on some of those big swing races in Pennsylvania for the midterms coming up. We're also maybe going to talk about those ice out bills here in Philadelphia and a whole lot more. Get your comments in studio2@whyy.org. The number 888-477-9499.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolf-Manera.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. And if you are just joining us, we're digging into the biggest stories in national and regional politics with two guests, WURD host Solomon Jones and Terry Tracy, founder of Broad and Liberty.
Next, we're going to keep rolling on politics, talk about some of these swing districts in Pennsylvania that are going to be key battlegrounds for the midterms. Of course, we'd love to hear from you. What's the top story you're following right now and why? Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. If you are on YouTube or Facebook, comment in the live chat. Nick says there is a nuclear option for dealing with gerrymandering at large state representation in the House. Conversation perhaps for another day, but good one to bring up, Nick. Okay, so speaking of the current arrangement and how we elect representatives today, I think there are probably four districts in Pennsylvania that are seen as like the key potential flips for Democrats. You got PA 1, Bucks County, Brian Fitzpatrick. You've got PA 7, Lehigh Valley, Ryan McKenzie. You got PA 8, kind of NEPA, Rob Bresnahan. And you have PA 10, Scott Perry. That's sort of like a South Central Pennsylvania district. I'm just curious, Solomon, any of those you're watching closely, do you think Democrats could really pick up all four there? I mean, what's kind of the prognosis for Democrats as they look at these four swing districts?
I think if you have any shot at all, it's close to Philadelphia. So I would look at Brian Fitzpatrick. I mean,
but he's been so resilient.
He has. But gas prices.
Yeah.
Inflation. Mm-hmm. Job numbers. So all of these things, again, people vote based on their pocketbook. That's why people were willing to ignore a lot of the stuff that Trump did in his first term and give him another shot. People who had not been involved politically were willing to give him a shot because they thought that they would make more money. Literally, in some of my community, you had a lot of people talking about, well, we're going to get another check. We're going to get another stimulus check. Mm-hmm. Where is it? You know, so yeah. I think when people vote based on their pocketbooks, party doesn't matter as much. So if anybody, if we have a shot anywhere as Democrats, I would think that it would be in Bucks County, closer to Philadelphia.
Yeah, are Republicans nervous, Terry? I mean, because you do have the Bucks County Commissioner Bob Harvey now has, you know, the backing of, you know, Governor Josh Shapiro. Josh Shapiro is very popular. People think that's going to be the wind beneath Harvey's wings. Your thoughts?
I think Shapiro's coattails are real. But I think the place where they're least likely to carry the Democrat across the finish line is Bucks County. Hmm. Brian Fitzpatrick has $7.5 million in the bank, which is considerable.
He's very well
chest.
Funded. Yeah,
he's very well funded. He's got strong bipartisan credentials and appeal for that district. He's sort of his own operation up there. I think to the extent Bob Harvey's a profoundly flawed candidate, and I think that's as you run through this list. It's one thing to say, are Republicans in trouble? It's another thing to say, well, sure. who is the challenger?
Well, and how about those other districts we mentioned?
Yeah,
McKenzie, Bresnahan, yeah. Perry. Anyone there you think, oh, boy.
Yeah, I think that – so when you go through this list and you look at the competition, I think Harvey is certainly a flawed candidate. I think Brooks in PA 7 is also a flawed candidate.
Assuming he wins, he is in a primary.
Mm-hmm. He is in a primary. It looks like he's probably going to get across the finish line based on the institutional support he has. But, you know, his issues, both in terms of not – like past social media stuff, but even just the way he's shown up in town halls and debates seems like he's not really ready to meet the moment. So I think that benefits Ryan McKenzie. I do think Paige Cognetti, the Scranton mayor, is running against Bresnahan, is a legitimate candidate. She is has demonstrated the ability to raise money. She's popular in the core of the district. She is an attractive candidate. Bresnahan has hands full. And Scott Perry is a rematch. Janelle Stenson you know, very telegenic based on her history as a member of the media. Last time she didn't live in the district, so she was viewed as sort of a carpetbagger, right? Yeah. She's since moved into the district. Mm-hmm. I think that's still going to be an issue for her. But if I was to force rank
this, she's raising a good
amount
of money as well.
She is, and she's got a primary. But I think, like Brooks, she'll get across the finish line, which is why if I force rank this, I think Fitzpatrick, ironically, is probably the safest amongst the four.
Just based on his money and his name, is what you're saying. Even though the fundamentals of the district might not be great for him,
and the results, I actually think the fundamentals of the district, when you control for partisan ID, are great for him. I mean, the reason why he inherited the seat from his brother was because he sort of carried on a brand that has become endemic to Bucks County and Bucks County politics.
Do you think, I mean, turnout matters, right? Because
it
matters who's who will be madder in November, right?
Right.
And, you know, this is a midterm election. You know, this is not a general with, you know, presidential election. So if Democrats are more upset and the independents lean over and they show up more.
Yeah. It's a purple state. I mean, you can't, you cannot take anything for granted, I think, in Pennsylvania based on your party.
And by the way, we got to switch. I know everybody's been talking about the third district race.
Yes.
It's still going. I mean,
here in Philadelphia.
It's right here in Philly. Everybody's talking about it. There was a protest today that I got an inbox, you know, a press release for outside of Chris Rabb's office with women coming together, mad at him about his sex trafficking vote on a bill in the PA House. Your thoughts? I would love to get both of your takes on who you think has the advantage here as we count down to May
19. Clear, it's just Democrats running, which is why we're not talking about the Republicans
here. Well, I think all three of them have some advantages. I happen to live in the 3rd Congressional District, and I also live in the 200th Legislative District, and so Chris Rabb is my state representative. And so I know all of those candidates and have known them for years. Mm-hmm. I love the work that Ali Stanford did during the COVID-19 crisis. Nobody else actually picked up the mantle and did that work like she did at that time. I love the fact that Sharif Street knows politics as well as he does. And I think that Chris Rabb is going to have a very enthusiastic progressive base. The question for me is who is going to be able to get their candidates out? We're going to be doing a...
You mean their voters? Yeah,
yeah, their voters. I'm sorry, their voters out. We're going to be doing a forum on Word tonight at 5 with the three of them. And so we'll see. I've moderated two of them so far with the three of them. I think all of them have their pluses, but you know, it's going to be a tight race.
Do Republicans care at all about like these types of battles within the party? Do you think there's some meaning here? And by the way, I will point out there was an Axios report, and you know, these are anonymously sourced. We'll say that Shapiro was maybe working behind the scenes to thwart Rabb. You know, again, take that all with a grain of salt. But do you think there's some significance here? That goes beyond just within the Democratic Party.
Well, since there's very little polling for this kind of race, I checked the Kalshi markets before we came in, and Rabb is at like 35% growing, which means there is definitely some late stage momentum. I saw the commercial he's running over the weekend. I think it was during the Sixers game, and it had the working families folks and Elizabeth, all the most progressive politicians in the city coming out for him in the commercial, talking
about
change.
And national progressives as well.
So Republicans do care about that, in the sense that for those in the party or in elected office that are, to Solomon's point, willing to work across the aisle to get things done, the folks in Rabb's are not looking to work with Republicans to get anything done. And Philadelphia's the health of the city is essential to the health of the state. And so, yes, it's not going to be a Republican in that seat. But having a Democrat that's willing to work with Republicans to get things done in Washington on behalf of the city and not just throw bombs all the time.
Who do you think that would be among the three?
I think either Dr. Sanford or I mean, Senator Street's been around for a very long time. He understands how the game's played. You know, Dr. Sanford's a newcomer. She understands some of the key policy issues. The challenge for both of them is it looks like they're splitting the non-Rabb vote. And what mix of that non-Rabb vote or non-working families, uber-progressive vote, particularly if that wing of the party is super motivated, and let's be honest, Democratic City Committee and the ward structure is not what it used to be. If I was betting it, I think a late break towards Rabb looks most likely. I think that's bad for the city.
But I think it's good for Republicans.
Yeah.
Because Rabb gets in and he doesn't work with Republicans, and Republicans can say, oh, well, he doesn't get anything done. So I think that... you know, there are some advantages. I think that Eli Stanford on the money side had an advantage. I think Rabb with the progressives and their enthusiasm has an advantage. But I think that Street, with that party structure, say what you might.
Yeah.
You're going into that voting booth. They hand you that thing and say, vote for these people. And you do.
It's a test, right? Does that still really matter?
And just like,
it's going to be interesting.
Democrats, progressive, liberal, look at, say, is the MAGA candidate going to take out, you know, like Texas, John Cornyn? Yeah. What's going to happen there? Republicans and conservatives are looking at this because it is the other side of the same coin.
Yep. And we're going to try to get to a couple more things before we wrap up the show. Got to ask you guys, Mayor Sherelle Parker signed the ICE Out legislation. At the same time, we saw letters coming from the House Judiciary Committee going to local law enforcement about their failure to cooperate with ICE. Any thoughts as does the signing of this legislation? I mean, I know it was... You know, override proof or whatever if you vetoed, but does it put a target on Philly's back now?
I think there was always going to be a target on Philly's back. The question was, when was it going to come? It's a Democratic-led city. Other Democratic-led cities across the country have been targeted by this administration over what's happening with ICE. And so I think it was inevitable. I also think that the legislation that the mayor signed was already kind of, you know,
already
what
there.
We were already doing. Mm-hmm. The only one she didn't sign, I think, was out of the seven, was the one about masks.
Right.
Because how do you have Philadelphia police officers confronting federal agents? And now you've got cops fighting cops in the street. Like, you know, so it was interesting. I think there was always going to be a target on Philly's back. But I think we had to stand up and say, no, this is wrong. Not here. You're not going to do it.
Yeah. Before we wrap up, I just want to mention one more thing that we wanted to get to. And there is a new poll by a group called NewsGuard about the April attack at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Mm. 1 in 4 Americans believe it was staged. 1 in 3 Democrats. I'm just curious for your thoughts on that, Terry Tracy. I mean, this is... We've seen this with going the other way, partisan-wise, for other, you know, major political events. The sort of... air of conspiracy that seems like it's just sort of everywhere right now. What do you make of it?
Yeah, it's not a partisan issue. Depending on the circumstances, you'll get partisans to respond differently to what's a conspiracy and what's not. But the reality is that we live in a low trust society, and there have been too many, not just years at this point, but decades of institutional failure that have resulted in people not willing to trust, whether it's media or whether it's government or whether it's some combination of the two, and in many cases, corporations as well. And so low trust societies manifest themselves in these kinds of results. And as a society that's based upon self-governance, it's unsettling, to say the least.
Well, we do have to leave it there. I want to thank both of our guests, regular guests, and we love having you both on the program. Terry Tracy, founder of Broad and Liberty, CEO of Fideri News Network. Terry, great to see you.
Likewise. Thank you, guys.
And great to see you, Solomon Jones, WURD host, columnist of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Good luck with the forum tonight, or 5 o'clock, right?
Yep, 5 o'clock.
How can people listen to that, by the way?
They can listen on 96.1 FM, 900 AM, or on the Word Radio app.
Thank you so much, Solomon Jones. Appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Let's read in a couple more comments. Andrea from Kennett Square says, I'm following the story about how the Strait of Hormuz closure is leading to a global threat to food supplies and could cause starvation. Deborah from West Philly says, not to diminish the focus on key U.S. Senate and congressional races, but what about races throughout the country, particularly the places that deny Biden won, where there are efforts to fill election verification positions with election deniers? This is a threat to our constitutional rights and fair elections.
Yeah.
That's a couple things on the minds of a couple of our listeners.
Yeah, we did have a caller. Sorry we didn't get to you. And thanks to everybody who wrote in and commented online. And of course, we got to say thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, and Paige Murray Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calicay engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.